most of us are so busy with our own problems and the details of wartime living that I'm afraid we don't take much time to find out what the other 100-some million people in the country are doing and thinking about. Our next guest on today's Country Journal has made a special point of learning what life in wartime America is like. He's traveled throughout the country, visiting with real people and getting the feel of how they work and what they think. He's Seldon Menifee, author of the book Assignment USA, a report on his experiences. I've asked him to be on hand today to tell about his visits with farm people, what they're doing and how they feel about important problems of the day. Seldon, what do you feel are the major issues that farm people are thinking about?
Well, Chuck, first of all, this time of year especially, I suppose they're thinking about getting the crops planted. After that, God and the weather willing, getting them harvested. With acreage hitting a new high this year, that's going to be a job. But American farmers are a pretty resourceful lot, and they'll do it all right.
They've done it the past few years, haven't they? Seldon, what have your observations been on this major problem of the farm labor shortage?
I've seen it at first hand in every section of the country, and it is a real problem. Vacant farms in Georgia and Texas, apples rotting in the field for lack of pickers out in Washington State. The wonder is that farm production continues to go up, and that so little is lost, relatively speaking, in the fields.
What do you think the prospects are for the coming season?
I suppose the farm labor shortage will be a little worse than last year, but not much. I believe the annual crisis will be met in much the same way as in the last 2 years. In addition to the usual sources of seasonal labor, more townspeople will have to turn out and help at the peak of the season. I've seen them do that in Lawrenceville, Georgia, and Carthage, Texas, and a lot of other places where the whole town would shut up shop and just turn out and get those crops in.
Those days it's pretty hard to find a place to get a haircut, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. They shut up all the stores except the drug stores in places like Lawrenceville when they turn out to pick cotton. Then, I suppose, too, the school kids will have to help out more than ever, as Mr. Schmidt and your two young guests today have already pointed out. More and more places will have to do what Madera, California has done, for example. Out there, all the schools above the primary grades go on half-time during the harvest season, and the children work half days in the field under the supervision of their teachers, of course. A year ago, more than 3,000 Madera's children worked on the farms and earned a total of $88,000. They saved many a farmer's tomato crop, too, and put in good licks on cotton and grapes and other fruits as well. I think of all the states I visited, though, probably Oregon had the best organized program for mobilizing farm labor at harvest season. Just about every able-bodied person has been recruited at peak seasons there. Wastage of crops has gone down to next to nothing.
Seldon, I know that from time to time we hear that farmers and people out in the country are a little bit resentful of Washington regulations and all. What's the basis for such farm resentment?
Well, Chuck, I suppose the biggest kick has been about the price control program. But even so, the polls, I mean the public opinion polls, show that only one farmer in six is stirred up about that. The second biggest kick is probably dislike of either the AAA or some other of the government farm agencies. But an even smaller minority expresses resentment of these programs. Fact is, farmers generally don't express any great distaste for Washington, in my experience anyway. And not long ago, a Fortune poll asked a cross-section of farmers, would you say that the government farm program has been good or bad for American farming as a whole? About 54% of the farmers said good, 18% said bad, and the remainder were undecided. The Gallup poll showed even more favorable results for the administration. And when a farm magazine polled Iowa farmers on the AAA, it found that two-thirds of the farmers favored that agency.
Here's something a little related, perhaps. Do you think farm people accept the so-called farm block as their spokesman? Have they got any beef on that?
Well, no, I don't believe they do accept it. As a matter of fact, I don't think most of them even follow its devious workings. One Nebraska farmer told me, those guys aren't dirt farmers. The only farmers they represent are the big fellows and the packing companies. The little farmers aren't organized, and the big fellows don't care what happens to us.
Well, how about farm organizations like, for instance, the Farm Bureau? Do you think they truly represent farmers?
Well, I suppose they do represent a certain class or group of farmers, mainly the most prosperous third. There's some question in my mind, though, as to whether they represent the views of even that group accurately. Take the question of price control, for instance. A Gallup poll last year asked a cross-section of farmers to define price ceilings. Now, only 3/5 of all farmers could do that. But of those who could, 64% were in favor of price ceilings, and only 18% opposed. However, and this is most important, 56% were in favor of price ceilings even on farm products, a 2-to-1 majority in favor of the government's farm price control program, of this very program to which the farm bloc is so strongly opposed. If the poll were taken again today, the results might be a little different, but I don't think they would be changed very much.
Have you talked to any farmers recently about that?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, I have. I was up in York, Pennsylvania, just a week ago today, and talked to quite a few farmers there. I think their views were pretty representative, too. Take, for example, Irwin Myers, Jr. He's a young man who works on his father's turkey and chicken farm a few miles outside of York. He thinks that ceiling prices are a little too low on certain vegetables, such as the 7-cent ceiling on cabbages. But he says that profits are holding up well as compared to recent years. His main complaint is that they're short the hired hand they normally have. But they're making out all right with all the family pitching in and working extra hard. That last, incidentally, is very typical. I've talked to dozens of farmers who are working 12, 14, even 16 hours a day to keep things running smoothly.
Every member of the family has his share of the work, don't they?
Yes, indeed. Then, too, up in York, I had a long talk with Harry Sprinkle, who runs a 127-acre dairy and vegetable farm out near Menges Mill, Pennsylvania. Now, he's growing a lot of canning factory crops this year, especially tomatoes and peas and beans. They're good-paying crops, he told me, and I figure that by growing them, we're helping the war effort. Mr. Sprinkle said he thought the farmer was getting a pretty square deal on the whole. He did complain that the price of feed and supplies seemed to be going up faster than the price of the various crops that he sold. But when I asked him if he would like to see price ceilings removed from farm products, he said most emphatically, no. He said if they did that, you know what would happen.
Evidently, he sort of carried out the public opinion poll that only 1 out of 6 farmers were opposed to price ceilings.
Yes, I think he was typical in that respect.
Here's something seldom that we may not think about so much these days, but it's in the back of our minds, I'm sure. Do you think farm people are as isolationist as they are usually described?
I certainly don't think that they are. That idea seems to come from the fact that certain of our farm states have been a little more isolationist than in their views than the nation as a whole. But Gallup's farm poll showed not very long ago that 77%, more than 3/4 of them, of American farmers, favor taking a more active part in world affairs after this war than we did after the last one. Now, that is almost exactly the same percentage as for the nation as a whole. As a matter of fact, most of the farmers to whom I have talked have impressed me as being quite well informed on world affairs. I don't believe they'll want to see this country revert to an ostrich-like policy of isolation when this war is over.
Mighty interesting observation. Well, many thanks to you, Selden, for the visit today. Our guest has been Selden Menifee, author of Assignment USA, published by Raynell and Hitchcock of New York City. Next week on the Country Journal, we'll tell about using the Jeep on the farm after the war. Of all the varied military equipment certain to be available after the fighting stops, seems that the Jeep has caught most everyone's fancy as a practical all-around farm chore boy. Tests in the field prove that the Jeep can plow and disc and harrow and do most anything in the way of pulling light machinery and implements. A power takeoff and belt pulley can be easily installed. There'll be nothing handier than a Jeep for getting over rough country and cattle roundup, for instance. And for that matter, it's ideal for getting to town and back with cream cans and eggs and other farm produce, even for taking the family into town on Sunday. The Jeep may be a common sight around the farm in a few years. Next week, too, we'll have a report on plans for getting fullest pork production from limited feed supplies during the coming year. Shortage of feed grains has made it paramount that hog numbers be reduced. On top of that, pork experts hope to encourage greater efficiency in feeding, management, and marketing to get more pork raised and marketed per pound of feed. It's time now for local and regional farm news. Spring farm work is getting off to a slow start this year in most parts of the country. Unusually wet weather has been the chief cause of delay. Farmers report they're as much as 2 and 3 weeks late getting into their field work. Not a great deal of spring planting is done before the 1st of April in northern sections, but as far north as Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Nebraska, spring grain planting is being done these days as fast as the weather will permit. Cotton planting has moved as far north as South Carolina now, and even corn has been planted in Tennessee and Kansas and through that area. Areas where spring wheat is usually planted this time of the year have been covered with snow most of March. Excessive rains through much of the Corn Belt and further east have kept farmers out of the fields most of the time. The extra moisture has been a welcome relief in one sense, though. Last fall's dry spell has been forgotten, and even some of the damaged winter wheat crops in Kansas and Nebraska have improved enough to make a fair crop. Crop reporting authorities figure the moisture supply is normal or above average now in just about all main farming areas. That's a mighty favorable condition for this time of year, even though there's delay in spring work. This spring's work schedule is just about the same as that of a year ago, when cold weather and too much water put farmers 2 and 3 weeks behind normal. But as last year's crops turned out, it didn't make much difference. Yields and production were far above average. A late spring may be more of a problem for dairy farmers. Short feed supplies make an early spring ideal so that stock can be turned on pasture as soon as possible. Wet weather usually means good spring pasture, but if cold weather continues into late spring, that delay in getting cows onto pasture will be a heavy drain on hay and grain feed. One bright spot on the crop outlook picture, southeastern fruit states report heavy blooming and prospects for an excellent crop year. They're just hoping that late frosts don't come along and spoil everything as happened last year. Right now, farm people are giving immediate attention to the business of getting crops in and producing all they can this year, but they're thinking a lot about what farm conditions will be like in the next few years, too. A recent check of farm opinion around the country gives a mighty interesting picture of how farm people feel about the first few years after the war. Here's Lee Hennefey with the highlights of the survey.
Farmers seem to be worried more about prices after the war than anything else. A majority of them feel we'll have as good or better prices as we have today for maybe a couple of years after the fighting stops. But the opinion is almost unanimous that after those 2 years or so, we'll be in for a big slump in farm prices. Main reason for optimism over those first couple of years is the belief that there'll be a strong export demand for farm products. Shipments of food to Europe and other places where war has created an urgent need for extra food. And farmers expect there'll be a strong demand for food here at home, too. Factories will be running at full production to supply consumers with things they haven't been able to get during the war. There'll be full employment, and everyone will be eating well. But when the couple of years of prosperity are gone, farmers are almost completely in agreement that we'll have another depression.
What's the thinking on ways to prevent such a depression? Any suggestions?
Well, farmers seem to be pretty much in favor of some form of government work to take up the slack in employment. It seems agreed that the important thing is to keep everyone working so they'll have money to buy food and clothes. Government programs of road building, soil conservation, public power, public buildings. Those are some of the more common suggestions for keeping down the ranks of unemployed.
What's the feeling on the government helping returning soldiers get started on farms?
Mostly favorable. A good many farmers believe that boys coming home who want to farm and have a reasonable chance to succeed at it should be given financial help and even some homesteading privileges on irrigated or reclaimed land that might be available.
Lee, I think most of all the feeling that farmers have about post-war prices is the most significant. This week, when Secretary of Agriculture Claude Wickard called attention to the very serious trend toward a farmland boom, he pointed to the dangers that farmers may be getting into if they expect continued high prices indefinitely and buy land at inflated prices, thinking they'll be able to pay for it at present farm prices. The fact that most farmers themselves expect a slump in these farm price levels is argument enough, I should think, that buying land at a high price now is a dangerous business. That land is selling for more and is selling faster these days is an established fact, however. The annual report by the Department of Agriculture on land sales and land value shows that farm real estate values have gone up 15% just in the last year. The present level is 38% above the pre-war average. One of the most interesting features of the report is the fact that a greater increase in the share of farms are being sold to non-farmers these days. A greatly increased number of the farms are resales. People have bought and resold the same farm within a short time. Seems appropriate with Easter just a week away that we at least mention the current surplus of eggs in the country. Spring rush of laying along with heavy production during the winter has put so many eggs on the market that market people are having nightmares about omelets, scrambled eggs, and the hard-boiled variety, too. Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. Hope you can be with us next week at this same time.
You've been listening to Chuck Wooster with the Columbia Country Journal. Today's broadcast came from Washington. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.